The pace of change today can be overwhelming. What's most important to pay attention to if you want to be creative, successful, innovative? I'm Bob Safian, host of Rapid Response. Rapid Response is a podcast that cuts through the noise, featuring candid conversations twice a week with top business leaders navigating real-time challenges. Leaders like Airbnb's Brian Chesky, the WNBA's Kathy Engelbart, and Khan Academy's Sal Khan. From the team behind the award-winning Masters of Scale podcast comes Rapid Response. Search wherever you get your podcasts to listen and subscribe.
Life is unpredictable. We may start the day or week or year with a certain plan in mind, only for things to completely fall apart in ways we never expected. This week, Reshma Sajani, founder and CEO of the prestigious nonprofits Girls Who Code and Mums First, shares the unflinchingly candid story of her struggles with fertility and how she learned to stop white-knuckling her way through life's changes, allowing herself the time to grieve, to laugh, and to feel. From Wait What, this is Meditative Story, where immersive first-person stories and mindfulness prompts inspire you to reflect on your inner life. I'm Rohan, and I'll be your guide. The body relaxed, the body breathing, your senses open, your mind open, meeting the world.
The waiting room at my doctor's office in downtown Manhattan is bright and white. Magazines sit piled on a corner table. Quiet conversation drifts over the receptionist's desk. My fiancé, Nahal, and I sit in a row of chairs against the wall. My body's here, but my mind is elsewhere, in my phone, knocking out work emails, as usual. I'm 36 years old, and I've built my life around being a hard worker. Well, not just a hard worker, the hardest worker. Whether I'm pursuing an Ivy League education or starting my own national nonprofit, I want people to see how capable I am, to see how much I can take on, to know I've always got this. When I put the phone down and look up, Nahal smiles. I smile back. We burst out laughing. I snap back to the present moment, to the reason we're at my OBGYN today, and I feel a rush of excitement. Work can wait for once. I'm going to be a mom. Nahal and I weren't planning on getting pregnant, but I've always wanted to be a mother. I was one of those girls with a million stuffed animals. I baby our bulldog Stanley as if she were our only child. So the day I find out I'm pregnant, it's a day of pure joy. I'm at work at the New York Public Advocate's office, and it's a beautiful day, but I feel sick. That's weird. I never get sick. That's when I realize my period's late. In my mind, I'm thinking, there's no way I'm pregnant. But I pick up a pregnancy test from the Walgreens across the street. It's positive. This is crazy. They say you should wait at least 12 weeks before telling people about a new pregnancy. But Nahal and I, we call everyone immediately. We're just too excited. We realize I'll be 8 months pregnant at our upcoming destination wedding. So that gets canceled. Our more traditional Indian parents, well, they're not happy about it. My sister's pregnant too, and I'm so thrilled we're going to have babies at the same time. The sun shines brightly over New York City, as if it's celebrating with me. Everything feels light, just joyous. Back at the doctor's office, Nahal and I settle into the exam room. The doctor prepares the ultrasound. I'm pretty far along in my first trimester. This checkup feels routine. My mind is already in the future, making plans for when the baby's here. The doctor starts the exam. I see her face grow serious. There's no beeping coming from the machine. The room feels cold, silent. After a moment, she turns to us and says very plainly, "There's no heartbeat. I'm sorry." I'm confused, shocked, devastated. No heartbeat? What does she mean? I've seen TV shows and movies that depict pregnancy loss, but it never looks like this. The women are always in the bathroom and are bleeding suddenly. They're not in a doctor's office, feeling fine. My eyes fill with tears. The doctor explains where to get a DNC, the procedure to remove excess tissue from inside my uterus. No one talks about this. No one ever explains that this is possible, and even for some people, a likely outcome. Everybody's body works, right? We're supposed to have babies, right? Pregnancy has always been presented to me in the most glowing light. So I try to live up to that example. I swallow my grief and I power through the pain. I'm at ABC Kitchen in Manhattan, a chic restaurant built into the side of a chic furniture store. The sound of clinking glasses and loud conversation fills the room. It's dimly lit, but I can still make out the faces of the high-profile attendees seated at the table. Author and wellness figure Deepak Chopra, chef and restaurateur Jean Georges. The host committee for tonight's fundraiser is a real who's who. I should know. I put this all together. I brought everyone here to raise an unprecedented amount of political donations. It took months of planning and hard work. In a few minutes, I'll be introducing the star of the evening, the man we're all here to raise money for, President Barack Obama. It's 2012. I stand off to the side of the stage in my new blue dress. My dark brown wavy hair falls around my shoulders. My black heels reflect the nearby stage light. Giant wooden beams of the rustic ceiling hang low enough to make me feel claustrophobic. Everyone is dressed in their business casual fineness. People walk up to me with smiles on their faces. A staffer asks me a question. A waiter rushes by with a tray of drinks. But I barely see or hear any of it. It's all a big blur. This should be a huge night for me. Not just because I'm introducing the president, but because of what it took to get here, to be in this room with these people. A few years ago, I launched an unsuccessful congressional campaign to unseat an 18-year incumbent. I was a huge underdog, and I put it all on the line, completely upended my life to chase after my dream. When I lost, I thought my career was over. I felt like I was this failed loser. My family's from South Asia. I'm the first generation Desi. I've always felt like an outsider. And the political establishment definitely wanted to make that the case. But I powered through. I kept working. Never let them see me sweat. Now, I'm helping to raise millions of dollars and being asked to introduce the most powerful man in the world. This is the ultimate form of perseverance. I should feel great. I should be on top of the world. Instead, I feel almost nothing. A sea of people brush by me, their voices muffled. It's been 3 days, just 3 days since my miscarriage, since my fiance and I were told there's no heartbeat. I haven't even gotten the DNC procedure yet. No one in this room knows what happened because I haven't told anyone, not friends, not family, no one. I hold it all inside. Keep it private. There's a real culture of silence around miscarriage and pregnancy loss. No bereavement benefits at work. No support groups I'm aware of. The people around me don't talk about it. So I don't talk about it either. Of course I feel sad, but I'm generally not a big crier. I don't really emote. When I get sad, I get very stoic. It's the behavior I saw modeled for me at a young age. When people in my family experience loss or felt grief, that grief usually comes out as anger, frustration, or silence. Everything from my upbringing to the culture sends me the same message. Buck up. Be tough. Keep moving. And as a woman, I hear that message even louder. My name is announced over the PA system. I step out of the darkness. The glare from the stage lights hit me. Behind me is a row of American flags. The crowd cheers. I smile. I act normal. This is perseverance too. My body perseveres through the pain and the loss of my miscarriage. From that acute sense of failure I feel. But really, I'm just pushing through the pain. I can't feel the magnitude of what this moment means for my career or what losing the pregnancy means for me personally. I close myself off from both. Like so many women I know, I feel like I have to be perfect, always. I have to keep moving. I have to be strong.
This is a difficult moment. Let whatever is here for you be here. Acknowledging the thoughts and feelings that are present. That too is a kind of strength.
400 girls cram into the school auditorium. They're all between 12 and 18 years old. Their voices echo off the polished floor and up to the high ceilings. Their excitement vibrates in the air. They're all so happy. Happy to be at this event. Happy that I'm here. It's 2018. I'm in Utah, where I've been invited to speak to a group of girls on behalf of my nonprofit, Girls Who Code. Our organization aims to close the gender gap in computer science and other technological fields by giving access and opportunities to hardworking, diverse girls from across the country. As the founder and CEO, I'm often asked to speak at events like this. So this experience isn't new for me. I know what's expected of me. My 30-minute speech is prepared. But something about today feels different. I feel shaky. I feel sick. I want to cry. This morning, I wake up at 4 a.m. on the West Coast to a phone call from my doctor back in New York. I'm given bad news. My HCG levels aren't rising. The fetus I'm carrying won't go to term. It'll be yet another missed pregnancy, my fifth. This news doesn't shock me anymore. I almost expect it. After our first pregnancy loss, Nihal and I try again and again for years. I have several more miscarriages, but I'm on a mission to be a mother. Our failure to conceive becomes so routine that we create a little ritual every time we get news from my OBGYN. We go to Potbelly, a chain sandwich shop in our neighborhood. I have the mushroom and cheese sandwich and a sugar cookie. Then I go home, hold our dog Stanley, and cry. Finally, in 2015, Nihal and I are lucky enough to have our son, Sean. Now we're trying for a second child and experiencing the same difficulties. We're no longer those naive first-timers in my doctor's office. When I lose a pregnancy, we know what questions to ask. I now know I have autoimmune issues. I take Lovenox shots and Heparin shots. I've gone through several failed cycles of IVF treatment. I think I figured out my protocol. The call this morning confirms that I am in the same pattern I've been in for years. And that pattern extends to my response to the news as well. I get off the phone with my doctor and I head straight to the airport. I fly to Utah. I take a car to the event and I walk on stage with a big smile on my face to the cheers and applause of hundreds of excited and eager girls. I take all the sadness and grief and I swallow it. I don't cry. I don't say anything. I don't feel anything. Standing in front of all these girls, seeing their proud faces, I keep thinking about how I always wanted a daughter. And the sadness of everything finally starts to catch up with me. There's nothing special about this event. It's not even the first time I've had to go to a public appearance directly after learning about a miscarriage. There's no reason that this is my breaking point, but it is. I'm losing that stoicism I've always had. I'm starting to feel less in control. I feel like there's something wrong with me, not because I can't get pregnant, but because I can somehow get this news, get on a flight, and stand up in front of hundreds of people as if nothing is wrong. This can't keep happening. I don't want to be this person anymore. I don't want to cut myself off from my heart like that. When I return to New York, I have an all-hands meeting with my team. We're in a shared workspace with several large tables and big windows along one wall. Before I even stand up to speak, I feel myself getting emotional. I had never been like this in front of my team before. I always want to be a strong leader in their eyes. Yes, they know the logistics of my IVF cycles and my struggles to get pregnant. But they don't know the emotions I've been holding inside. They don't know the pain I've been hiding. Now, I let it all out. I tell them everything. And then I cry. I need a break, I say. I need to take a break. Without hesitation, everyone in the room looks at me and says, "We got you." I've built such an identity around the fact that I got it. I always got it. It's part of what it means to be me. No one works harder than me. No one bears pain as much as I do. I don't need anything. It's a badge of honor that I've carried my whole life because of how I was raised and how the world told me I needed to behave in order to be successful. Of course, I've heard all the talks and seen all the seminars on the power of vulnerability. I'm even self-aware enough to tell the young women that work for me, don't do this like I am. But actually being vulnerable in this way, asking for help and crying, it's very well off-brand. And it's exactly what I need right now. I can't push through the pain. I can't close myself off anymore. I need to open up.
What can you open yourself up to in this moment? How can you loosen your proverbial grip? What is here that you've maybe not noticed before?
It's spring of 2024. I log into my Zoom call with every intention of reading a poem. As the squares populate my screen and I see the faces of my team, my colleagues and employees holding mugs of coffee or quickly fixing their hair, I already feel myself starting to cry. I cry more often these days, and this past week has been especially hard. My beloved dog, Stanley, has died. As a kid, I always wanted a dog, but was never allowed. My parents think they're dirty. When I lose my bid for Congress in 2010, Nihal tries to cheer me up by driving me out to Pennsylvania to look at some Beagle Bulldog mixes for sale. When I see the brown and white face of this little puppy with a slight underbite, all I can say is, that's her. We're getting her. Stanley is my first child, before we're blessed with our two sons. She is there to lick the tears off my face after all five of my miscarriages. She spends Mother's Day with me when I'm feeling angry at my body and angry at the world. I grew up in a household where my parents never hug or kiss in front of me. Stanley opens up my heart. I parent in a very different way now. Always kiss and hug the boys. Stanley taught me how to do that. She's my constant companion through everything. And now she's gone. The more you love, the more you grieve. This grief feels so heavy. But I try to handle grief differently now. The week I find out Stanley has cancer, I immediately tell my team. I'm outwardly emotional. I show them how much this hurts and how hard it is to process. Of course, I'm not perfect. Stanley passed away last week, and I threw myself into meetings and speeches and distractions right away. By Friday, I realized I'm just falling into the same old pattern. At the Monday morning meeting, I make sure everyone knows that they shouldn't do it like this. If they have a death in the family, they shouldn't work through it. They shouldn't just buck up and be strong. They should give themselves time to properly grieve. I want to close the meeting with a poem I read recently that really moved me. But at this point, I'm crying so much that I can't get the words out. Across the screen, I see my team crying too. This collective expression of the heart brings us closer together. I walk away from the meeting not feeling any amount of shame about the interaction. If anything, expressing my grief makes me feel lighter. When I used to push through the pain, my grief would make me so angry. Angry with myself for failing to become a mother. Angry with everyone else for making it look so easy. That's because I was holding all my pain inside. Now my pain comes out as love. So many of us are trained to think that if we want success, we have to compartmentalize our life. We have to put work first. We have to sacrifice our heart and our soul in favor of our mind and our ambition. We hold in all this suffering, all this pain, all these unsaid feelings with a tight grip. But really, the best thing we can do is let it out. Because there's power in being open about our pain. Open about how much we care, how much we hurt, how much we love. We build empathy and compassion for one another. Only when we see what each of us is going through, when we loosen that grip and let the tears fall where they may.
Thank you, Reshma. There was so much to Reshma's story, so much to be moved by. I've always believed in being human in the workplace. From my first job, I was taught the idea that being professional meant not bringing your emotions to work. But as I became more experienced, I gravitated to places and teams where being myself and being expressive was more welcome. You can do it too much, though, so it is a balance. To start this ending meditation, let's take a moment to check in with how we're feeling. We all have our own relationships with grief and loss, and Reshma's story may have brought up some stuff for you. It's okay. Trust your instincts. Do what you need to do. And if it feels okay, let's acknowledge our feelings, just as Reshma did. If you like, you can give them a name. Sadness. Tenderness. Blankness. Wishing. Whatever emotions are here, just give them a name. And if you think it'd help and it feels okay, why not place a hand on your heart? Feeling your hand there and breathing. Actually, let's take a few breaths here. Connecting with what is happening for you right now. The emotions. The physical sensations, Let's be more open. Let's be more direct. What's here? For me right now, what's here is some calm, some interest. What's not here is sadness. A little while ago, while listening to Reshma's story, difficult memories of mine came up, and I felt a twinge of sadness. But it's not here now. What's here for you? And what's not here? And can you be okay with it all? Things just are, or they're not. Breathe, think, feel. We don't always have to hold tight. We don't always have to push it down. Sometimes we feel happy, sometimes we feel sad. All of these feelings are okay. It's all okay. Thank you, Reshma. And thank you. On behalf of the team at Meditative Story, thank you for spending time with us today. We love creating the show for you. And if the show serves you in a meaningful way, we'd love to hear from you. Would you take a minute right now to write us a review in your podcast app? When you leave a review, it really inspires our team. And we're a group who derives so much energy from understanding how Meditative Story impacts you. It's also a way for you to pay it forward by helping others discover the show. So if leaving a review speaks to you today, we'd really appreciate it. Meditative Story is a Wait What original. Our executive producer is Jay Punjabi. The series is produced by Dorothy Abrams. Our VP of music is Ryan Holiday. Original music and scoring by Eduardo Rivera. Our scriptwriters are Marie Kalaru, Dan Nealon, and Florence Williams. Mixing and mastering by Brian Pugh. Wait What was co-founded by June Cohen and Darren Triff. Special thanks to Sarah Tarter, Mariel Carica, Kay Rugg, Nikki Williams, Tim Cronin, Sammy Oputa, Louisa Velez, Colin Howarth, Brandon Klein, Brad Whirl, Timothy Lu Lee, and Dave Fisher. And I'm Rohan Gunatilaka, creator of Mindfulness Cards and the all-new Mindfulness Cards for the Family, and your host. Visit meditativestory.com to find the transcript for this episode.